Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and I'm looking for an unputdownable book. To help me are my friends Ian and Joe, two English teachers.
I'm Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for an unputdownable book, I would recommend Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher, too. And Nick, if you're looking for an unputdownable book, I think you should read The Hobbit or There and Back Again by J.R.R. Tolkien.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs. Okay. Maybe I've come to the right place because I do have a question.
Great. Hey, guess what? Good news.
Yeah.
I'm not going to speak for Joe, but I can answer your question if they have to do with a very specific subset of culture, namely literature. Joe, would you agree?
I can answer questions about Dungeons & Dragons, Settlers of Catan, or like seven books.
Joe is...
Catan. He even said it like a dickhead.
I've been playing a lot of Catan.
Stop saying it like that. How is unputdownable a word? How is that a word? How did that make it through a word?
Well, it's one of these weird words that... Okay, so I just Bing searched it, and it is
okay,
an informal adjective. Like, Bing recognizes it. Merriam-Webster does, too.
Joe, can you jump on Ask Jeeves? Let a
yep,
second source go
right
here. All right, so Ian, go ahead.
I snapfished it. I went on snapfish. Anyway, it's weird that there are these words that... We know the sense of it, but there isn't a really good English word for it. I think one of my favorite sort of like cultural contact types of story is when folks who speak other languages, who grew up speaking other languages, encounter English and say, well, like, how do you say, you know, the classic German Gemütlichkeit? Folks who grew up, folks who grew up speaking German, like, how do you like, what's the English word for that? Like, there isn't one. It's like, Gemütlichkeit refers to a whole range of things that the English language doesn't distill down into one word. So what was I saying?
It sounds like one of those words that was added in like the sooner rather than later in history.
I'm sure.
Yeah, like in 1998 or something. Like that and Bootylicious came in the same year.
Dear.
Let me share a couple other recent additions to the English language.
Fantastic.
Swole. Huh. Hold on.
Isn't that swole?
If you really... Yeah, it is.
Swole. Swole.
Swell.
Here's one that was added in 2019. Mm-hmm. Topical.
Okay.
Unplug.
What?
And I think that has always been a word.
Wait, what?
So, yeah, I think it maybe got a new definition.
What list are you looking at?
This might be a bad list. I am on Ask Jeeves, and it has taken me to a terrible place. On this podcast, every week, we pick a theme for no reason other than to allow us to bicker. And that theme, every week, you guys bring a book that plays to that theme. This week is Unputdownable. We'll see about that. And
foreboding.
So you guys brought Of Mice and Men and The Hobbit.
Yes.
So let's go with Joe because I know a little bit about The Hobbit. So
awesome.
let's start off with Mice and Men.
The mystery.
Now, just off the cuff, what do these books have in common? Do you think anything?
Well, actually, I have one thing that they have in common right away.
Okay.
They are both written and published, well, probably published, in 1937.
I'm just double checking that that's correct.
Yeah.
Was Of Mice and Men like written in the corner of some like old pub, like all the Lord of the Rings books were? That's the story about the Lord of the Rings books, right? He just kind of wrote them in some pub.
Absolutely not. That's not what happened. I have a really good story about how he started writing The Hobbit, but I'm not going to share it now.
That's unfortunate. That's because it's not your turn. Joe, tell me about... tell me about Of Mice and Men.
So, Of Mice and Men is written by John Steinbeck, who's a famous American author. Wrote other books you might have heard of, like The Grapes of Wrath, like Travels with Charlie, like East of Eden. Like, there's a good chance that if you grew up in America, that you have been exposed to John Steinbeck at some point.
I grew up in America, yes.
I also grew up in America.
It's been established. We all grew up in Wisconsin.
Joe, oh, okay, did you grow up in America?
I grew up in America.
Is Wisconsin America?
It is. It's Northern America, but it is America.
Middle America.
As you were saying. Just
Middle Earth.
Oh, really feel like. Nick really wants to talk about The Hobbit.
I feel like that too.
I kind of do.
This will be a constant struggle. Oh, I'm so, like, you guys, I'm super nervous.
So, Joe, you can continue on about your book, but I am going to try to reference The Hobbit as much as possible.
So, written in 19...
Hey, I'll keep a tally. I'll keep a tally.
Thank you, Ian.
Written in 1937, and I think a lot of times when we look at that, it's hard to... It's just a number. It doesn't mean much. Like, we kind of place the World Wars, we kind of place the Great Depression. So, I'm going to give you some other things that were happening during 1937.
Good. A little flavor.
Fantastic. I hope you weren't planning on also doing this, Ian, because this could be a bit repetitive.
To be frank, I had not considered the possibility, so go right ahead there, Joe.
Go for it, Joe.
In 1937, FDR was inaugurated for his second term of office. Amelia Earhart disappeared over the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Dang, that was that year.
That was that year.
When in the year? I don't know.
She disappeared over the Bermuda Triangle?
Yeah.
Nick, did you not know this?
Is that how she died?
No, she's not dead. She's not dead. She's living. She's living. You see, she's living in Argentina with Hitler.
I had no idea.
Are you serious? You didn't know that Amelia Earhart disappeared? Holy cow.
Yes, but not over the Bermuda Triangle. Oh. I didn't know, though. I never heard that was related.
I don't think it was. I think it was the Pacific.
It might be. I don't know. I think I saw a TV show when I was a kid.
Oh, okay. So Joe is just talking out of his fucking ass. Gotcha. Okay, cool.
I'm used to teaching a class full of students who are more apathetic, so they don't question the things that I say.
Will not fact check you.
I refuse to be fact checked. She disappeared over the Bermuda Triangle. I stand by it. The Hindenburg also exploded or caught fire and was tragic in 1937.
Over the Bermuda Triangle. I remember that, yeah.
And in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge was finished in 1937.
That's a big year, dude.
That's a big year.
You should wait for the 40s. It really picks up.
Cranks up.
Keep going, Joe.
Yeah, so I thought the Golden Gate Bridge was interesting because this book, like so many of John Steinbeck's book, is set in California. And it's set in the Salinas Valley in California. And I like that the Golden Gate Bridge is finished because we think of California today as this like cool, surfy, like economic powerhouse, you know, like vacation-y place. The California that Steinbeck's writing about here, though, it is agricultural California. And he writes a ton of his books. East of Eden is heavily based in this area of Mice and Men.
Now, Joe, is that where they grow Lambert's bread?
I don't think Lambert's bread is grown. I think it's made by the elves.
He checked you, Nick. He checked you down.
Oh. Fuck.
I'll add a little glasses pushing fact, a little nerd fact. Limbaugh's bread doesn't show up until the Fellowship of the Ring, which was published more than a decade after.
God, nobody cares. Nobody cares.
You're Joe, keep going. Who's making Please references. Tell us.
Quiet, you.
So, of Mice and Men, the plot of it is relatively simple. And you actually might be familiar with the plot in broad strokes because it's one of these things that has, it's become part of Western culture. It's become part of American culture. Of Mice and Men is about these two guys, George and Lenny. And they are a couple of buddies. They travel together looking for work. They're both migrant farm workers. And the short story of Mice and Men, the shortest way I can say it, is these two guys get a job on a farm, they work there for a while, and that's kind of it. There's obviously like plot points that happen in there, and there's... Right.
Thank you for bringing the book to us, Joe. That sounds great. Is that... I look forward to reading that one day.
But
Ian,
Joe, is that
can you
it?
Tell us about The Hobbit?
Is that it? I feel like there's something huge that happens at the end of this book.
Well, I don't want to talk about that because there is.
Okay. In case it makes him sad.
I feel like, well, Nick is so spoiler averse, and I'm kind of against that. Like, I think a lot of times when you're talking about literature that's 100 years old, you can spoil it. I don't want to spoil Of Mice and Men at all, because there's some impactful things that happen in Of Mice and Men. And the reality is this is an unput downable book. This is a book that you can read in a sitting, and it's a book that I did read in a sitting, although not until I was an adult. I never read this book until I had to teach it. And Ian, I wonder if you've been in this same position sometimes. I got hired at this school that I work at now. There was a curriculum in place for me, and out of the curriculum, there were a handful of books I had it taught. So I was tasked with reading these books either with the students or ahead of the students. Of Mice and Men is up. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I didn't mean to cut you off there. I was just going to say, so you're English teachers. How does a book... Okay, so Of Mice and Men, I'm pretty sure everybody's pretty familiar with the story, but how does a book like that get selected over, let's say, The Hobbit? Like, how does a book get selected into...
Well, they didn't listen to our podcast is what happened.
How does a book get selected and put into rotation like that so heavily? Like, why this book? Is it because it's so short and you can read it in a sitting?
So do you want to know the English teacher answer, or do you want to know the real answer?
Give me both.
That's an amazing question. Good job. Well done.
Thank you, Ian. Give me the English teacher answer first, and then the real answer, and then the English teacher answer again, please.
Got it. Okay. So books like Of Mice and Men.
Yes. Don't screw this up.
Respect the sandwich, Joe.
We're watching.
Keep going.
Books like Of Mice and Men, they are foundational texts in Western literature. Right. They carry something important about our cultural identity. They carry something important about our beliefs, our thoughts, our fears, our feelings, all this. And they're packaged in a beautiful way. Right. So when we talk about books that are part of the Western canon, and if I just asked you to name books that you'd heard of, you would start ticking off books from the Western canon pretty quickly. It's those books that what's the phrase that literature is books that. Ian, you know this, but literature is like books that people...
Speak to the human condition, universal.
Yeah, sure. That's not what I was thinking. I was thinking of the phrase. Okay. I was thinking
Let's
of the phrase
Let's wait until
that,
Joe thinks of it.
I think it was Mark Twain. I'll speak confidently.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Literature, like classic literature is the sort of thing everyone should read and no one does read.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yes. And I feel like that is so much of what we teach in high school, right? And I think... the thought process is getting away from that a little bit. I know in the curriculum work we're doing, like, we are getting away from that idea, but so much is still like this classic literature that carries like these huge themes, these huge emotions, these huge maybe lessons, etc. So that's
condescending from Twain, huh?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't think of himself as writing classic literature, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, sorry.
Okay, so that's my English teacher answer. Anything you'd add, Ian?
Give us the dirt now, Joe. Give us the real answer.
So the real reason I like teaching Of Mice and Men is because it is short. It captures students' attention. They read the whole thing, and there's a twist. And that's it.
Nice.
Yep. That's why I like teaching.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
The principles of all good literature.
So the question of canon building, where how do we build the canon? How do we construct what goes into our curricula is fundamentally shaped by forces which we don't acknowledge. So if you look carefully at the canon and you hear these comments, I know Joe, you're not putting these forward. I know you're presenting them as like this is what we're told. Mm-hmm. You hear these comments, it speaks to the human condition. It speaks to the way we interact with the world. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the characters, the main characters, you look at the stories, you look at the authors, they are by and large white men. So the canon of Western literature, the great books, capital G, capital B, great books, these talk about us, and us is in scare quotes, us being white guys. And
yeah,
so
I mean,
this is something totally. which I think is a problem that has, as Joe mentions, is being addressed. Like, we are paying attention to, oh, wait, maybe there's more than one human condition. Maybe people from different cultures have a different experience of the world or a different way of making knowledge. But for so many of these books, especially these older classic, again, scare quotes, these older classic books, they're in there because they express something about white male human condition, as opposed to any kind of like legitimate universality.
Yeah, totally. All right,
first episode. Let's get into race.
Well, I mean, not only race, sex, gender, all these things. And I think it's really class. Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you talk about that, Ian, because I have a couple more fun facts about Of Mice and Men. But one thing that I think is super cool about this book, and I guess let me talk about my first experience reading it just a bit and why I chose it for the Unputdownable episode. It's a short book. And Nick, when I say short book, I mean that you wouldn't even call this a novel. You would probably classify it as a novella.
Or a novella?
Well, I would say novella.
So it's Spanish.
Like so much in California. Yes, it is a novella. And Nick, when I say short, like my copy in front of me is 93 pages long. So it is very readable in a sitting. If you sat down and started reading this book in earnest, I think when I read it, maybe 2 or 3 hours, I want to say, it took me on a Sunday afternoon before I taught it, right? It's that kind of... approachable and accessible, but B, just engaging and this wonderful little place to spend an afternoon in. There's not a ton of characters in this book, right? Like
You got the mice.
You got the men.
Yeah.
And there's a
dog. Which is which?
Yeah. At least twist, three.
One of the men is actually a mouse.
But to get to Ian's point, talking about just this marginalization of literature, we get the main characters here are George and Lenny, and they're these couple of dudes that travel together. And the most obvious thing when you see them is Lenny is this big, strong, dumb guy. And when I say dumb, he's cognitively impaired. There's something going on with Lenny. But he's a fantastic worker. He's like really good to have as a farmhand. And George is this small, quick guy who is kind of Lenny's caretaker. They say they're cousins, but it seems like maybe they're really just friends. They never really give people the full story of how they know each other, but it really just seems like they've been buddies for a really long time. When they go to get hired at places, for example, George will yell at Lenny and he'll say, "Hey, when we're talking to the boss, don't say anything, because if he sees you work before he hears you speak, he'll hire you. But if he hears you speak, we're going to be looking for another job." Right? And it's like this really hard scrabble life that they lead, going from farm to farm, following the crop, doing this like bucking grain bags, like just like this heavy, hard work together, as they kind of eke out an existence in the Salinas Valley.
When is this book set? Is it set like in the kind of ebbing
1937. Years? 1937. Please pay attention.
Well, that's when it's published. Written.
Is it set like in the ebbing years of the Great Depression, or is it like pre-depression? How does that factor into it, if at all?
Yeah, so it's post-Great Depression, but it is before like Dust Bowl years, right? So when we think of a Steinbeck book that he would write later, help me out. I said
Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath. When we think of Grapes of Wrath, like that's really about the Okies coming to California, like this terrible poverty that people are in. That's not the world of Mice and Men. Like George and Lenny, they live this tough existence, but they do live in a place that's economically pretty viable, right? Like it's a place where they work, they get paid every month, the harvests are good, they go into town, they go to a cat house, they spend their money, and then they come back and they work again for another month.
So why is this book unputdownable?
So,
besides the physical length of it, because I don't think that's the great.
Well, but that's got to factor into it, right?
Factor.
Like, oh, absolutely. Super,
like when you get into it, if you start watching a half hour TV show, you might get to a point where you could say, I could stop this and go to bed, or I could just finish it.
Okay. So besides it being short.
So I think the things that I love every time I read this book, and I read it once a year with my students, but the things I love every time I read this book and the things that absorb me again are, of the characters in this book, none of them are particularly happy, right? None of them are having a great time in the world. You know, we get the main two characters, George and Lenny. They live this existence that's pretty tough. Like they go from farm to farm, they work there until the work is finished, and then they go and try to find a new job. And they try to save money in between. They try to eke out an existence, but it's tough. However, the two of them have this dream that they follow the whole time. And this dream is this constant thing that comes up throughout the novel of they want to get a little piece of land of their own, a little farm, have some rabbits, have some chickens, right? And just have this little piece of land that they can quietly work on their own, and they can own their own work, right? And this dream is, it's tantalizing for them in the way that it seems like it's always just out of reach, right? It's always just over the horizon. They save up a little bit of money, and then all of a sudden, like, that something happens and they have to leave town, or something happens and they have to, like, blow their money. It's this, I don't know how to phrase this.
Take your time.
Yeah.
Lift with your legs.
None of the characters in this book are particularly happy. Like, none of them are living high on the hog by any means. However, it is still like this kind of nice existence that they have. So George and Lenny, for example.
Simple.
Yeah, it is this simple existence. George frequently tells Lenny, and Lenny recites along with him. He says, hey, look at all these other guys that we work with, right? Like, their life is terrible, and I'm paraphrasing here, right? Like they're lonely. Guys like us were the loneliest guys in the world. But for you and I, it's not like that, right? Because I got you and you got me, right? And it really is. This brotherhood.
Was it Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
They have the stuff.
They have the stuff at the base.
Yeah.
And so
mice. They have, and then the next level is men.
What? Let's walk through them. Food, shelter, clothing, mice.
Mice, men. Self-actualization is in there.
So they're aware of. So they're. Would you say they're content?
They're good. They're all good.
No, I would not say they're content. Because they want this dream. They want this farm, right? Like, they want this thing. They want their work to belong to them. That's like with this thing that they're constantly in pursuit of throughout. So they're making it work, but they do have this dream. They do have this goal. And vitally, unlike all these guys around them, right, who get paid, go to the cat house, drink whiskey, and come back to work for the next week, right? Unlike all of these guys, for George and Lenny, it seems like this dream might be attainable. That's why I use the word tantalizing, right? It's just there, this entire book, right there.
Is that it? Like, give me an example as you're kind of going through the book. Like, what, is it just a rat race? Mice race?
Of rats and mice.
Yeah. I think this book is about these two guys trying to make a good life in a tough world. Is what I would say it's about. I wouldn't say rat race because they're trying to get ahead, but it's not competitive. It's not like this hyper kinetic book by any means, but it's just them trying to achieve this dream of independence, this dream of having a homestead.
Hey Joe, is this a quest? Are they on a quest? Is this a quest book? I'm getting paid for every time I say quest, so I'm trying to say that as much as I can.
What do you mean? Give me an example of a quest book.
The Hobbit.
For example, The Hobbit.
No, but this is, I'm going to talk about this when it's my turn.
Sure, like, are they searching for this one thing? Are they searching for this thing?
Are they moving? Are they deliberately moving in a particular direction in order to attain something?
They think they are.
Oh, right? No.
Yeah.
They think it's a quest, but it's actually what, like, not?
So every time they talk about this dream in this book, and this dream is absolutely central to this book, right? It is like the thing that keeps the momentum of this book moving forward. There's times when they get really, really close to it. But the tragedy in this book and the thing that keeps you coming back and breaks your heart every time you read it is that every time they take a step toward their dream, Lenny does something bad. Oh, right. No. And he does something bad that he can't help doing because
is it always Lenny?
It's always Lenny.
Like, yes, it is. Yeah. Oh no, Lenny.
So every time they take a step closer to this dream, Lenny does something bad and they take two steps back. They have to run away. They have to spend their money. They have to, like, lay low so that people don't, like, hunt them down and lynch them at one point, right? Like they're always – Lenny gets in trouble because he has this child's mind is how you would describe it, how it is described in the book. Lenny gets in trouble. So there's this tension this entire book because on one hand, George and Lenny's dream is more attainable because they're together. Right? Because, like, they make double the money every month, for example. They room together, right? Like, it is more attainable because they are together. But it's also less attainable because of Lenny. So there's always this.
He's a liability.
He's a liability.
A liability.
No, it's nothing.
And there's always this tension of why does George keep Lenny around, right? Like, why doesn't George just ditch Lenny, right? What does George get out of this relationship? And the answer, when it comes right down to it, is that Lenny's his friend, right? And George would be lonely without Lenny, because if he ditches Lenny, he is no different than all those other ranch hands who are the loneliest guys in the world.
So Lenny's supposed to be like this big brute, right?
No, don't think of him as a brute. Think of him like a big, gentle bear.
Okay, but he is supposed to be big and strong, right?
Oh, he absolutely is big and strong.
How did John Malkovich get cast as Lenny? Like, what? In what world is he the big,
strong
guy?
It was John
guy?
Malkovich's lost years as a bodybuilder.
Yeah. I'm looking at this movie poster, and he is maybe... it's just fake. It's completely fake.
Isn't Malkovich super tall? Isn't he super tall, though?
But
he seems, when you watch that film, he seems big, right? Like, they make him seem big throughout that film.
Kind of like...
And he's also like...
Ian, can you think of any movie in which they made people through movie magic feel bigger than other people on set? Now, just take a moment to think about it. Don't share any answers right now.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
He's 6 feet tall. This is bullshit. We're going to debunk this. All right, who's the other actor? It's John Malkovich is 6 feet tall.
And the guy from Law & Order. Gary Sinise.
Gary. Oh, good reach. Gary Sinise. Here we go.
Sinise.
5'9".
That'll do it.
Okay, but here's the thing, okay? I love John Malkovich.
I'm looking at a good half foot. I'm getting at least
the
half
John
foot.
Malkovich, his physicality, okay? His physicality is the physicality of a big
Tell guy. Us about the physicality of John Malkovich.
I think they kind of stuffed his shirt. Like, I think because he looks like, you ever hear the phrase farmer strong, right? Like, he's not ripped by any means. He's a big, heavy dude in this.
I say it every morning as I wake up. I look in the mirror.
Joe, why should somebody read this book?
It has the ability of just transporting you to this place, to this story, to these characters who are like incredibly three-dimensional and incredibly realized, even though you don't spend very much time with them. I think so often we end up talking about books that are kind of sad. Right? Like these books that aren't feel good books. Like, they don't have like these big payoffs, right? Like, they don't have, you know, Frodo dropping the ring into Mount Doom, spoilers, right? We have instead like this book that's sad and melancholy and also like sweet and hopeful at times, right? And tells you true things about dreams and loneliness and friendship, right? So if you say, why do you read this book? I think it's those themes, right? It's that theme of this like friendship that George won't leave Lenny behind, right? It's this theme of this beautiful dream that they're both striving for, that they're both going for. And it's this theme of loneliness, which is a bummer, but it's also something that I think a lot of us recognize in our lives. It's a thing that like speaks to a lot of us, especially when I teach this book to high school freshmen, you know, like especially when you're that age, it's like, yeah, you feel lonely sometimes.
I'm going to read you a 1-star review of Mice and Men.
Love it. Yes.
And I'll just give you a heads up. It is long. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but this person has spent time articulating his 1-star review in a very well thought out way. So let me just give you the highlights here. Jacob B. 3 months ago, wrote a 1-star review.
You have to put his name. Name and shame, just like make it anonymous.
No, fuck that. This is public.
Yeah,
that's his name. Yeah, and I get to decide.
He's gonna be doxxed after our legions of heartfelt fans listen to this episode. They're gonna chase him down.
All right, John Steinbeck interweaves a variety of complex commentary throughout the book, offering an insight into the world of the character. Okay,
so far it sounds pretty positive.
Yeah, this book sounds amazing.
To see where it goes bad.
Yeah, really good so far. All right, it does have good layers, but again, in the standard curriculum, the novella falls short of representing the ideas of writing and would be a better fit for a social studies class surrounding the Great Depression. Interesting.
Huh.
Strongly disagree. Yep.
Okay. Furthermore, the writing style may fall to entice readers due to the jarring switch of perfect grammar to slang words. Equally so, the descriptions really only take place at the beginning, making this novella a play script more than a story to be read.
I really don't like this.
I just love the amount of groaning happening. All right. Last but not least. All right. To summarize, this content is very low and bland. Hold on.
Despite all that good stuff I said at the beginning, it's actually terrible.
Though, easily picked apart, it's missing the key elements that should be required for standard education, as it lacks the plot elements that need to be included for a proper case study for American literature. Wow.
That's word salad. What are those elements, George?
His name is Jacob.
Whatever his name is.
Jacob.
Jacob. Ugh. That's one of the things I really don't like is when this, like, when authors use dialect or slang or kind of whatever, like, they take on a voice and readers say, this is bad because it's not perfect grammar. I got news for you, buddy. Nobody uses perfect grammar.
No.
None of us speak in complete sentences except for myself.
Yeah.
We human beings using language.
Hold on. Here's where it really turns. So
is this more from Jacob?
Yeah, here's another little more from Jacob. This story lacks any plot throughout the novel, simply following a somewhat thrown together idea of character growth. The ending is technically foreshadowed, but the first four chapters lack any form of inciting incident. The fifth offering the incident and the sixth chapter, this is nonsense, sixth chapter climaxing and ending the novella. I hate how much he uses the word novella. I hate it so much.
It feels kind of pretentious to call it a novella. Just that's a pretentious sounding word.
But let's just assume we're also pretentious because we started a literature podcast. Now let's stick to the facts here. Joe, do you agree with what he's saying? Is there terrible character development? And does it not have a plot?
I think one of the things that's interesting about this, when Jacob says that it reads more like a play at times, one thing that Jacob would be happy to know is that that was actually John Steinbeck's intent. He was trying to,
no way.
Yep, he was trying to write a novella.
Suck that, Jacob.
You are kind of right, Jacob.
He was trying to write a novella, as Jacob would say, that could be read as either literature or as a play. And when Jacob says, like, the description happens at the beginning and the end, that is 100% true. Like right at the beginning of this novel, we get this extensive description of the Salinas Valley, this extensive description of setting, right? And again, we get this same extensive description of setting. And it really does feel like opening up a curtain and seeing this scene and then watching as that curtain again closes over that scene, the world having changed slightly for the events of this book.
Great. And I assume it ends with them realizing their dream and
yep, happily ever after is actually the last words in this book. Happily ever after.
Without spoilers, Joe, I'm really curious.
Yeah.
Did you feel like the conclusion of this book is built up to, and as you say, the twist, is it built up to kind of honestly, or is it feel kind of like a bait and switch?
No, totally honestly. In fact, the first time I read this, I think it comes off as totally earned. And every time I read this book, I see additional elements of foreshadowing. I see like other little nods, other little hints. Like this book is short, but it is just this beautiful little perfectly constructed present. Like I think it's wonderful.
Great. One wonderful book down. Ian, tell us about The Hobbit.
The Hobbit is a tale of misery and sorrow. It's not wonderful at all.
Sweet. Can I kick off your review? Here I know this is highly irregular, but I'm going to start off with just a review of your book, just to give the audience a nice level set on what they can expect and if it's good or not.
Now, who is this from? Is it from you or is it from Jacob?
This is not from Jacob. This is from Ava, also 3 months ago. There must have been a convention or like some sort of reading marathon. Something
happened 3 months ago.
The great reviewing. So I don't know what your review is, Ian. We're going to find out shortly. But here's Ava's. All right.
All right.
I would not recommend this book if it's the last thing I do. Let's stop there.
Wait. Okay. That's a confusing first sentence.
If it was the last thing she ever did, it wouldn't be to recommend this book. I don't know what's confusing about that to you.
So if she had like one more thing to do, if she like people told her,
yeah, she had a
you
list.
Can do one more thing, take one more action in the world.
Yeah. Well, the first thing on her list would be, okay, don't recommend The Hobbit. And then she would,
wow.
Would that be crossed off or is that a double negative?
So that's it. But is that it? Is that like, Is her action saying, don't read this book?
What is so exciting about a hobbit who goes on an adventure and almost gets killed? It's not teaching my children good stuff. Not impressed.
Oh, no.
It's a mom. It's a mom review.
And you said her name was Karen?
No. This is why schools haven't adopted this book. It's not good for kids. I thought that was helpful. So, Ian, tell us about your opinion. Do you also would you give this book a 1 star?
I would give it 1 star, and then I would give it another star, and I would keep giving it stars until I was out of stars.
Oh, gold stars.
I think I would give it all of my stars.
Wow. Fantastic.
It's a good book.
That's where I'm standing on this. I'll just like rattle off a couple of just little fun nuggets of information about it.
Share your nuggets with us.
You guys aren't ready for these nuggets. So as Joe stole my thunder, yes, it was published. This was also published in 1937. Let me tell you some things that were happening in 1937.
Amelia Earhart. Steinbeck.
John Steinbeck published Of Mice and Men. That's it. That's all I know. No, it is. It's really interesting because, like, another thing that we hadn't mentioned, but like in 1937, it was pretty clear that something bad was going to start happening pretty soon in Europe. The Nazis were very much on the rise, and if you were like Tolkien, who had fought in World War I and had called it things like the Great War or the War to End All Wars, like you thought that was as bad as war could get, and then you see like, oh, here we are again, and the Germans are at it again, and. It's like a big old bummer. And there was still hope. There was still hope for peace, but like, yeah, you had a sense it was going down. And 2 years later, 1939, is when war was declared. So the first edition, no one really expected it to do super well. It was published in a first edition, first printing of 1,500 copies, which is not that much. And it sold out super, super fast. So it was published in September. 21st of September, and it was already sold out by December. And they were already in December. They were already asking Tolkien for a sequel to The Hobbit. Wow. So it's extremely super popular. And the reason this is important is it was published. It was printed again, same edition, repeated printings. But by 1951, Tolkien was getting ready to publish The Lord of the Rings, and The Lord of the Rings kind of positions some of these characters from The Hobbit in a bit different way. And so what Tolkien did was he went back to The Hobbit and he revised certain key narrative aspects of The Hobbit so that they would be in synchronicity. They'd be copacetic with the
Lord of the
Rings.
Fascinating. He retconned it. He retconned The Hobbit.
He absolutely retconned The Hobbit. So long story short, the ring is in play and Bilbo wins the ring fairly in The Riddles in the Dark in the original printing. And then as we know, if we've read the book since, they changed it so that it's less straightforward, less fair and above board. And this kind of fits with the changing character of Gollum and the changing character of the One Ring. So these changes and a few others as well make the original edition, the first edition, very valuable.
Mm. Are 1,500 books, are those around at all anymore?
Oh, heck yeah. And you can you can still buy them. They're absolutely collector's editions because the first edition in the hundreds of thousands.
I'm on it.
Which is...
Hold on. I'm also on it.
Oh, good. Trust you guys. Hey.
210,000.
Yep. So the first edition, and I'm talking like the first printing of the first edition, featured a cover design which was drawn from Tolkien's drawings. And apparently Tolkien was like, "Oh, I'm a terrible artist. You guys shouldn't use this." And I'm like, "No, dude, this is incredible."
He was not a terrible artist, was he?
He was secretly a really good artist.
Secretly great.
So that's a cool thing about it. Tolkien doesn't know. He doesn't have a source for the word hobbit. The famous first line is, "In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit." And he doesn't know like where he came up with that, which is weird because so much of this book is based on other stuff. He was a scholar and he knew a bunch of different languages. And so he drew a lot from sort of fairy tales and folklore and myth and legend. But he doesn't know where hobbit comes from. So Tolkien wrote this first sentence. He had a family. It was the 1930s. He had a family, early 1930s. He had a position at Oxford College, but he wasn't making a lot of money. And so he was grading student papers to make extra money, make ends meet. And this is still something that English teachers do today. You can grade people's papers for money for various online schools. But he had the physical copies of the paper, and on a student's paper, just on a whim, he jotted down the words, "In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit." And he didn't know like what it meant. He didn't need to know where a hobbit came from. He had no idea where this was going. And if you read the first like couple lines of this, you kind of still get a little bit of that vamping where it's maybe like, and he obviously edited a whole bunch, but you kind of get the sense that maybe Tolkien is feeling his way a little bit. The first lines being, in a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit, not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and an oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort. So, like, you can kind of almost hear him, like, kind of feeling around, what is this? You know, Tolkien had no idea what this was going to become, like a multimedia empire. He didn't even know it was going to be a book. He wrote a lot for his kids. He loved telling stories for his family. He had sold a couple of things, but he was not a professional. And he didn't even know it was going to be like a commercial success.
Right.
He was surprised when it made a bunch of money.
I was surprised when the second and third Hobbit movie made a bunch of money.
Yeah. Can we talk about the Hobbit movies? When are we allowed to talk about the movies?
Yeah. Oh, boy. Guys, come on. Let's save that. I do. We should talk about them, but let's save it.
Save it for what?
I would like to say that the Of Mice and Men film is extremely faithful to Of Mice and Men and critically acclaimed.
Well, except for the height.
I love the idea of Peter Jackson taking Of Mice and Men and stretching it into three books, three movies. So the book has never been out of print. I have two more facts. This is one of my favorite facts. Cool. I really want to get
it. You should start with your favorite fact.
I know, I ramped up to it.
I know. Here we go. I'm looking at my notes. My favorite fact is still on my notes left unsaid. So I really hope I win.
What
so
is
I get
it?
To, No. I have to win now. That's
save it,
all
there
save
is. Save it for your inevitable win. Okay, here's the last cool fact. In 2003, paleontologists in Indonesia discovered a really small skeleton, like I'm talking like 3 feet tall.
Oh my god!
Of a humanoid.
I think I know where this is going.
Well, the nickname for this is the Hobbit. They were not hobbits,
and this was found before 1937.
No, 2003.
Damn, that's after.
They're considered to be like a separate species, to have been a separate species from Homo sapiens. But it is like this is when you kind of Google for scholarship on like academic papers on The Hobbit, you get half like literary criticism and half like
weird skulls,
bone science. but the best part of this is the Tolkien estate, which we'll talk about them some more eventually. The Tolkien estate will not let scholars use this name for commercial purposes. So like if you try and like if you're a scholar and you've got like some like a public lecture to deliver about this particular humanoid skeleton and you say like you refer to it by this nickname, the Tolkien estate might track you down and say you may not call it The Hobbit. Even though it's science, even though it's public, they say commercial purposes, you can't use our trademark. And this actually happened to a lecturer in New Zealand.
I have a question about this Hobbit skull. Come get me.
Yep.
Come get me, Tolkien estate.
They're gonna shut us down.
What how is this not just like a kid? Oh, is that dark? Have you done any research on this?
Oh, you bet, dude. When I found out about this, I was like, no way. So of course I read that. And I learned that I'm not a bone scientist.
A bonologist.
Yes.
A bonologist.
Bonerologist.
But like the teeth, they judged based on the teeth. The teeth were like adult teeth and were also worn down over a course of like decades.
Yep, that'll do it.
So
maybe the kid just ate rocks. Like, maybe that's why he died.
That is definitely deadly. It's gonna. The book is in the first edition, which is illustrated. The book is 300 pages long, but the audiobook clocks in at 3 hours and 45 minutes.
That's tight. So that's a tight 3 hours.
It is. It is. And it's just so like, oh.
So you could, wait, hold on. This is interesting.
Yeah.
Are you saying you could read, wait.
Yeah, it's not adding up.
You could read the book faster than you could watch the movie?
That's such a bad benchmark. That's got to be like a hall of shame.
Oh, God.
I've never heard of that.
For movies whose runtime is longer than the audiobook. Oh, my goodness.
Well, certainly.
Oh my
All
God.
Three of them.
Yeah.
I will tell you, one of my wife's favorite films, and to be honest, one of mine too, is the 6-hour Pride and Prejudice miniseries from the 1990s, where Colin Firth is wearing like a wet t-shirt. And that is a lot of hours of movie.
I like how you gave like three identifiers from that. You're like 6 hours from the 90s, Pride and Prejudice. Colin Firth wearing a wet t-shirt. It was like the fourth fact that you gave about it after
the
title.
Like, this has become the white
is this a meme?
The white ruffle, the wet It's, oh, dude, Google.
I'm way ahead of you.
Hey, all of you folks, everyone listening to this podcast, it's time for us to talk. Hop on your Google machines, or if you're like me, on Bing, and image search for the statue of Colin Firth coming out of the wall.
It's right here. Terrifying. It's fucking enormous. And if you just do, I back you up on this, Ian, if you just do a quick search of Colin Firth's nipples, it will be the first thing that comes up.
Wow.
Just Colin Firth nipples. First image.
The British have a wonderful habit of taking these kind of these classic moments of male sexuality or male objectification, like when the male body is objectified, and making huge, terrifying statues. When I was in London a few years ago, there was a statue. It was a temporary installment of the you know, the when in Jurassic Park, the original one, when Jeff Goldblum is like sitting there all sultry like with his vest kind of open and so forth.
Yeah. Yes, I do.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. Can you describe it in great detail?
you can probably Google that, okay, too.
Let's keep
this is going to be a lot of us describing things that we Google.
Yeah. Cool.
Describing images, erotic images of men.
some sculptor or statue maker made a full color, much, much, much larger than life statue of Jeff Goldblum doing this pose.
Okay.
Like in the middle of London. And it does show up in my nightmares sometimes.
Could you just do, could somebody plan like a road trip around the world?
Oh, it's a good
thing. And just
theme.
Hit up,
yes, I
like
think someone could.
Sexualized large statues of actors in the 80s and 90s.
It sounds like it would just have to be around England.
I mean, there's two. I'm not sure if there's probably
there's
more
no though. Way we just happen to name the only two. That's all I'll say. There's just no way that those are the only two that we happen to stumble across in this episode.
There's probably more out there.
I think people should just send us statues. Send us half naked men statues. That could be our Twitter thing.
Nick has a new house. He needs to decorate the yard. He would like to populate it with statues of half naked men.
Actors. Specifically actors.
You know, and here's a chance for us to be very relevant.
Ooh,
in these
yes.
days when people are pulling down statues and throwing them in rivers. Good. Throw them in the river and then pull it out and send it to Nick.
Yeah. No.
Send Nick statues of racists and he'll melt them down and sell them for scrap.
No, you've missed it completely. Take down those statues, destroy them because they're terrible and garbage. And put up more statues of 80s and 90s actors, sexualized men.
Of course.
Sexualized men.
Of course.
We can rename our military bases after 80s and 90s actors, yes. Sexualized.
Yes. Here's a Dothraki you could put up.
Oh, yes.
Maybe.
That feels a bit too on the nose.
Okay. There's just so many. There's so many.
Is there a David Bowie?
I like the idea of a statue of David Bowie coming out of the water and call it the David Bowie.
Oh.
Yes.
It's yeah.
I love it, actually.
Good stuff.
Okay.
So that's why you should read The Hobbit.
So thank you, everybody, for bringing your books.
I'm going to tell you why it's unputdownable. It has an absolutely unstoppable forward momentum. You know the word binge-worthy? Have you heard this word?
I've heard that
word. Yeah, that was added to the dictionary in 2019.
Good, yeah.
It's everything I hate and love about TV all at the same time.
There's something to it. There's something unique to it that you want to sample again and again.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of every chapter, sometimes there's cliffhangers. Sometimes it's just like phrased so well. You're like, I got to see what happens next. I got to see like what they get up to next. And there's also this incredible, this beautifully created build where it starts off kind of humble. It starts off in this hole in the ground, in the hole.
Very unassuming.
Who lived a hobbit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of like hobbits. And so the book's scope grows along with its central character. And then he participates in this huge climactic battle. And if you've read the book or if you're familiar with how it goes, and specifically in the book does this really well.
What if people aren't? Give us the 1 minute. Just in case. I mean, honestly.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I think everybody's familiar with it, but like give us the 1 minute. Give us the story.
So Bilbo Baggins is an unassuming hobbit who likes comfort. His house is invaded by an old friend of his, Gandalf, and Gandalf's 13 dwarf buddies. And through a series of machinations, Bilbo finds himself setting off on a quest with the dwarves to retake their homeland, which is the Lonely Mountain. Lonely Mountain is occupied by a dragon. They make it after many adventures and travails. Bilbo picks up a couple of magic items along the way.
A ring.
Spoilers. And Sting, too, which is important. And
the singer.
And Bilbo ends up, he runs across the singer. It's a sort of alternate reality.
Yes.
And the other thing so is, weird. It's so familiar. It's this quest structure, which we know from a variety of other media, almost every like pop, I think almost every big pop culture story does this, the quest structure. You know, you've got your protagonist, you build the team and you have some adventures and there's a catastrophe and then you get the thing that allows you to conquer the bad guy. Everything is lost. You seem like you've hit the peak of the action and then it's not really. Then there's a further real action after a climax after that. So it's familiar, but you get into it and it.
Yeah, so I think you just answered a question that I have. When I think of The Hobbit, I love this book for a lot of the same reasons that you love this book, Ian, right? Like, I love, like, this tale of heroism, like Bilbo Baggins is all of us, right? But I always remember what I think of as the two endings to this book, the climactic battle with Smaug, right? That feels like it should be the ending.
Yes.
Why isn't it? Yes. Like, why doesn't it end there? Isn't it more beautiful if it ends there? And like, they're on this quest to take back the mountain. They're on this quest to kill the dragon. And you know what? They killed the dragon. Story over.
So with this double ending, I think it's really interesting that Tolkien does this. And I wonder if it's connected to the sort of threat of war in Europe again, and the sense that something is looming. So you have these two climaxes where the dragon, this singular embodiment of evil, like all evil is localized in this dragon. He is killed. But Tolkien has been through World War I and he knows that's not how it works. He knows that you can't just like put an end to problems are a way of coming back in different forms. And he also knows that like interpersonal conflict is the source. So you've got this, the source of a lot of evil. You can't just say like, we don't have dragons roaming around, but we still have, there's still evil in the world because people clash and fight. And so this final battle is driven by a combination of greed and selfishness and anger at each other, bad decisions, hurtful speech. And you have to have this war climax. But the beautiful thing is that our main character, our point of view character, Bilbo, doesn't see the whole thing. He doesn't see the dramatic ending. So in the book, it's so good. He's like watching it and he's grown. He's changed. He has a sword now, but he's not some great warrior.
Yeah.
He's just trying to stay alive. And as things kind of develop and the battle seems to be coming to a climax, you think, okay, here we go. This is going to be the dramatic triumphant. Like, and then Bilbo gets hit on the head with a stone. And the chapter ends.
Yeah.
And it's like,
it's a real cop out.
It's not a cop out though, because this is not like, he's not like Superman.
Yeah.
He was never going to be the one to like run up to the Night King and stab him with a special knife. And that was it.
Spoiling
that was
everything now.
I don't care.
Michael Superman Scott dies. Spoilers.
This is not Bilbo. And it's so true to Bilbo. I think. It's tempting. We're also always, as we read these books, these like fantasy books now, we expect our main character hero to be the linchpin.
Yeah, they solve the problem.
That solves everything. Absolutely. You know, he or she develops the skills or is granted the magic or finds the sword and they're the one to strike the final blow. But Tolkien's like, nah, man, this is just a little dude and he's not good at fighting. And he gets hit on the head and he has to hear secondhand about the dramatic conclusion. So I think it's brilliant. It's also funny. I'm not going to like give you examples because that just, I'm going to butcher him, but it's a pretty hilarious book. And Bilbo is this character who's got a very sort of sensible outlook on the world. And
nothing funnier than that. Nothing funnier than good sense.
Good old sensible hobbits.
Good head on his shoulders. Really funny.
He's going through all these crazy things, and Bilbo's responses to them are kind of the responses that we would have. They're kind of the responses like sort of dumbfounded confusion.
Yeah, he like plays the straight man in the comedy routine.
And I think that's really a beautiful thing about this book, which Lord of the Rings maybe it loses a bit. The sense that like fantasy is pretty fantastical. It's pretty crazy. Like the stuff that happens is pretty crazy.
I can't believe you've reviewed this entire book and you didn't even include that the dragon talks. I remember when I learned the dragon talks, that blew my mind. That was the first time I've ever, obviously Sean Connery aside, that's the first time the dragon could talk. That was the weirdest fucking thing to me ever.
Nick, if you play D&D, you know that dragons have a very high intelligence.
They do.
High int score.
Right. This is I'm not going to get into this too much because I could talk about this
for
hours.
We could go for hours.
Forever.
Talking intelligent
Tolkien,
dragons. I know.
Tolkien is very aware of sort of the traditions of folklore and folk tales. And one of the things that you get in, especially the old Germanic folk tales that he was interested in studying, Icelandic stuff, Norwegian and Scandinavian, was these creatures, these dragons, which are not just beasts. They are something else. They're special. And so the idea of the dragon, which is conniving, which is incredibly malicious, incredibly powerful, very evil, is straight out of that.
I think the winner today is quite obvious. Joe, congratulations.
That's very kind.
You've won our first.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Very good.
So obviously, Joe, I think you won today because your book is in school literature. This is a part of schools across the nation agree that this book is a classic, therefore making it the best book. So
that is how English class works. I thought you did a great job with The Hobbit. I legit want to reread The Hobbit now.
Yeah, I don't think that's the last time we'll talk about The Hobbit.
I hope not. I didn't really get like to talk about it, but like you've had those experiences where you consume a piece of art and it just stirs you. It just like grabs you in a way. Like books, like fun books are one thing, but I'm talking about like the thing that you say, this is going to be part of me. This is formative.
Yeah, it's formative because it's so obnoxiously unique.
Oh God.
It's like it just hits you over the head with the fact that nothing like that has ever been written or will ever be written without being compared to it. So it is it is so singular.
I mean, and how much of the fantasy genre is just entirely dependent on that? You know, we talk about we stand on the shoulders of giants, right? Like fantasy since The Hobbit, it doesn't exist without The Hobbit, or at least doesn't look anything like it looks without The Hobbit.
Or looks too much like it.
I think it's a combination. The magic of that book is it's a combination of we see how influential it is, and it stands on its own. It's not just valuable because it's an influence. It's valuable because it's legitimately by itself good. And I just wish the movies had been better.
I don't like to normally draw such hard lines in the sand, but I will for this. I think that the books are better than the movies. And I hate to be so controversial.
I think you're the first person to say this.
Hey, can you tell us the fun fact? I'm curious.
Yep, absolutely. So John Steinbeck, an early edition of this that he had written, he was kicking around this book. He wanted it to be short. He wanted it to be like a play. And he had this manuscript written, and the manuscript was called Something That Happened. But it was what would become of Mice and Men. He had one copy of that manuscript, and his dog ate it. And he writes his editor explaining that he will not be turning in his manuscript on time because it was eaten by his dog. And I have the telegram in front of me.
No, hang on. Is his dog named Lenny? Is Lenny based on his dog?
No, his dog's name.
The dog ruins everything for him, and so he writes this.
No, he only calls it the setter pup. No. He doesn't give the dog a name here.
Good try, though, Ian.
Yeah.
But,
he says, minor tragedy stalked. I don't know whether I told you. My setter pup, left alone one night, made confetti of about half of my manuscript. 2 months work over to do over again. It sets me back. There was no other draft. I was pretty mad, but the poor little fellow may have been acting critically. I didn't want to ruin a good dog for a manuscript. I'm not sure it's good at all. He's only gotten an ordinary spanking for punishment via his fly swatter. But there's the work to do from the start. I should imagine that the new little manuscript will be ready in about 2 months. I hope you won't be angry at it. I think it has something, but I can't much tell yet. I'll get this off. I hear the postman. John Steinbeck.